next session, number 28750, reel 12.
Laurie Manton, reel 12.
If you can imagine the photo of this lady on the slab in the mortuary, and she looked like a jelly. She was jellified, but her features were still there. It was unbelievable. You know, she was jelly, completely jellified. On the left, it told the story in no uncertain terms in English, but they had Serbo-Croat language versions of how she was deliberately run over by these nasty Serbian people. And the medical report underneath says precisely, blow by blow, what the impact was on her body of this happening. So you then turn over the page, and it's a young man who was hit in the head by a sniper bullet. Dum-dum bullet, you know, cross carved in the front, which meant when it went in there, it split out the metal. So you had a small hole going in here, but it just blew out the back of the head. So you'd have the photographs of that, and this is a whole series of A4 books in full colour, and they're that thick, and all the way through is photo of someone killed by the Serbs, the circumstances and the medical consequences of them being killed in that way.
These were for public consumption?
For public consumption. And they cost the equivalent of 50 pence each. I think it was terrible, because what they were doing, the Croatian government, was, if you like, brainwashing the population that they should hate the Serbs, when they are probably as guilty of committing similar atrocities. So you've got the nightly hour of the latest fighting from the front. Look at us, martial music, we're killing the Serbs. All these books of what the Serbs had done to our poor, innocent public. And it was self-perpetuating. It was utterly appalling. I think 50p for one of these books. So I bought a set. And then they had fantastic sets of posters. Huge posters, professionally produced, and it might show a ballet studio, but there's no wall, and there's like a wooden floor with bits of damage around. You know, this is a nasty thing that the Serbs had done, or damage to a church, but it was self-perpetuating, and it was brainwashing, and it was the worst sort of propaganda, and it was utterly appalling, and that never got due recognition. So they must have had their photographers working, their official photographers working overtime. Now, I'd started taking photographs of the damage, because when you travel through some of the areas, you traveled through places where they'd had near lakes and forests, they'd had holiday chalets, because it was always a very good tourist area. But these had all been torched. So you'd be going along and you'd be seeing the remains of a burnt down holiday chalet, one after another, all along the side of the road. But because they were built of wood, you had ashes, you had a stone or brick chimney stack, and you had a washing machine, the metal of a washing machine with a circle front loading, every one of them. And that's what you saw for miles and miles and miles at the side of the road, just completely burned.
Surreal, isn't it? And eerie, you know, to see that repeated.
It is. Yes. It's very, very strange to see all this going on. Now, I was lucky enough when the... I'll come back to Bob Stewart in a moment, but when the Cheshires were relieved by the Princess of Wales's own Yorkshire regiment, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Alastair Duncan. I was lucky enough to be taken on patrol in a warrior fighting vehicle with the same officer, junior officer, who'd a week previously escorted Peter Howson, the official war artist, into the hills to see some of what was going on. And they'd said that on his first visit he got very nervy and very nervous and literally had a sort of breakdown and had to leave the country because he couldn't cope with what he was seeing and what everyone else was seeing, the horrors of all this. It's quite understandable. But we were taken up to see a village to see how they were getting on. And we came in this village and there was no one around. And the Serbs had just come into that village on the road we'd come in on and worked their way through the village, and everyone had run for their lives except for those who were shot. So we parked up and the Serbs had gone on. They were obviously chasing the villagers up into the hills to murder them. I thought, this is quite interesting, so I'll go over here. And I went in the church and it didn't look too bad. Then I looked a bit closer and I thought, oh, this is a Catholic church. I'll go in through there because that's where the priest keeps his vestments and such like. And these were all stored in wooden drawers which were floor to ceiling, but they'd all been opened and all these wonderful coloured garments that the priest wore when he was celebrating Mass were all hanging out of these drawers, not unlike the plastic flowers I'd seen coming out the back of the vehicle in Iraq on the Mutla Ridge in that convoy of death. So I got some quite interesting photos of that, and then I went round and I found a family home. And they'd been cooking a huge loaf of bread. We're talking sort of dustbin sized loaf of bread, big chunk of it in the oven. And obviously the house proud woman of the household, everyone said run for your life, so she switched the oven off and opened the door of the oven and pulled it out so it wouldn't get overcooked, and it was there still steaming away. But the house had been ransacked. And I looked and I thought, gosh. And there was a passport of the father of the house, which I've still got. I kept it. And he had, until the year before, been working as a Gastarbeiter, a guest worker in Germany, earning a wage, not sure what he worked at, for years and years and years. And, you know, there was his passport with the details. And he'd had a problem with the leg, with his knee. And there were his x-rays from the doctor, who'd obviously said, you know, carry these around because you might need to refer to them. But a whole house had been ransacked. And I thought, I'll take the passport so I know the story. So when I got back and wrote the story, I said, you know, in this village there lived a man called, but when I arrived no longer, although his passport lay on the floor, and then told the story that
bread
way
in the oven.
But the, you know, the imagery was just fantastic. It was deserted. Absolutely deserted. But these Serbs were terrible because they'd shoot the farm animals, the dogs and everything, set fire to the cars and burn the houses. Now, if they were taking over those areas, they could have lived in those houses. But it was deliberate destruction. Burn everything. But then you had people who were well-meaning. The peace activists. Yep, let's be wonderful and show our support, and we'll take supplies out to the people. So There was a wonderful convoy set up which travelled across Europe to get to this thing, and it was known as the Convoy of Hope. And when it neared Vitez, the coach leading it, coach with people on the helpers, ordinary civilians, followed by trucks with load of material. Boom, mortar shell lands right in front of the coach as they just stopped temporarily. Took the brain out of the head of the driver. And then all the Serb people came in and looted all the charity supplies, medical supplies out of the trucks and burnt the vehicles. So I'd been told this tale by the squaddies who'd gone out on a quick reaction force to see if they could do anything. I had come up to Vitez in another army truck and had passed by this coach, and all this stuff that was strewn all around it, blankets and things like that, that weren't worth looting, and these wrecked trucks with all the back off and all the rest. Oh God, that's seriously weird. And someone said, yeah, the driver had brain removed from his skull by the force of the explosion. And I can remember sitting down in the army's photo archive one day, a couple of years later, and coming across photographs taken by the army photographers of the scene straight after it happened. And I just turned over a photograph, and there was the tarmac with the chap's brain sitting on it. So it was documented, and that remains in the records, which is quite astonishing. Then they also photograph as sort of a documentary record the guy minus his brain sat in the front of the coach and things like this. So they have been documented, but they've not seen the light of day, all these photographs.
It's interesting you saying about the, humanitarian people, the peace people. How incredible that they were allowed into these very dangerous areas, without any protection.
It's very, it's mind-bogglingly stupid, and they particularly caught it. Yeah. And that all stayed with me.
It shows naivety and lack of knowledge of what the true situation was. Was this...
You had people that did organise charity convoys and such like, and there was an English woman who became known as the Angel of Mostar.
Sally Becker.
Sally Becker. Now, from what I hear, she was universally detested. But she organised her convoys properly, and therefore they worked. And she did, despite what people may say. So many people seem to hate her, and it was almost a media-driven hatred at the time. She did a good job, and I think she got something like a OB or MBE after that. But they had all sorts of scurrilous stories about this. She was a beatnik lesbian who just gets in the way. She actually did a good job. And because she looked different to most people, they have this dreadful, the British thing of let's take a pop at them. They're trying to do good and try and destroy the person. Completely ignoring the fact that the ineffectual UN is failing to protect these people, and you've got the people in Split and Zagreb having their themed lunches in hotels every week with their huge allowances. Now, I think the whole thing's terrible, but you can bet your bottom dollar that photographically there's little of these themed dinners in the photographic archive.
How about people like, I think you were there at the time of General Rose, weren't you? Who was the head of UNPROFOR?
Yeah, Mike Rose was a funny chap, because he was Special Forces. And And I come across him first of all at one of the distant army bases that was quite difficult to get to. And he was stood by the side of the road. He'd come up with his SAS bodyguard in his armoured Land Rover, pulled up, jumped out. And I always thought he stood effeminately. Yeah, he didn't look like a soldier, and yet he was a trained killer and all the rest of it. And he was SAS. So can you get a photograph? And he said, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. So he took a photograph. That was easy. But he was aloof, if you like. And I'd been taken to... I'd been given the opportunity much later on to actually interview him during a visit he was making to the British troops. And they decided to produce a local language newspaper which put the United Nations views across to say, it's all wonderful, you're all safe, ethnic cleansing has stopped. And the lead story was General Rose saying, you know, it's all over, we've won, and everyone's safe. And he came in, and they had all the pages laid out, again in an old school, on like the science benches all around the edge of the room. And he went from page to page, sticking his fist through the proofs. Because they'd put words in his mouth, and he'd never said it was all safe. And yet they made up words for him to say for this propaganda newspaper to give out free to all the locals. So he was very aggrieved. So having blown his top with that, he then came up to me and I started asking him questions. And I'd say, you know, is it a particularly tough time at the moment? No. And he became monosyllabic. And I'd say, do you think there's any difficulties with, you know, the British forces and the French Foreign Legion working together? No. And I thought, blow this, I haven't come all this way not to get an interview. And I said, I'm not going to waste my time with you, General. I'm here to get a story for Soldier, the Army's own magazine. And if the best you can do is say yes or no, then I'm not prepared to take this interview forward. I'll stop it right now. He said, that, and you know, I could hear his aides fainting, you know, crashing to the floor in terror that someone actually spoke to him like that. But you know, it had come a long way. I'd risked my life, and if he wasn't going to give me a story, then I wasn't going to waste my time. And then he gave me a really good interview, which is what I always found. If you push them hard enough and stand up to these sort of people, then they will give you the story. But having seen him put his fist through all these proofs, I thought, gosh, yeah, he really is tough. But when it came to his leaving his appointment in Sarajevo, by some chance I've managed to get back into Sarajevo, and got invited to his going away do in his headquarters. And that in itself was quite interesting, because they'd made an effort to make the buffet meal that evening a real multinational United Nations style meal. And for example, there were cubes of Edam into which there were cocktail sticks on which fluttered little cardboard Dutch flags. So it was a buffet of all nations, and these great big trays. And, you know, I, for example, grabbed the Edam and then I wandered around and like a waiter and gave it to people, and they had their Edam. And then someone else had a go at, you know, handing out the pork pies or the scotch eggs or things like this. But he was very interesting because he was completely and utterly relaxed. He was surrounded by all people who worked by him in the past. And I had a couple of young soldiers with me who were privates, you know, the lowest of the low. And he went up to one of them. He says, "Oh, I see you've got a camera, lad." And he said, "Oh, yes, sir." He said, "Give it to someone. No doubt you'd like to send a photo home to your mum of you and me stood together." He said, "Oh, yeah." And so he said, "You know, Major Sanders, will you take a photograph of us?" So all the junior people were able to get a photograph of the two of us together. I'll never forgive my soldier photographer who shot a blurred photograph of me with the general and my tray of things. But I was quite interested and shocked in a similar way to see that one of his farewell presents was an oil painting that had been sent to him as a present, which had been sent by the great war criminal General Ratko Mladic, from one general to another, and it was accepted. I suppose there was no way of getting it back to them, but it was, you know, hanging up there in the corridor as one of the presents he's got. But I don't know what happened to that painting. Now, the media at the time had realised that Ratko Mladic had given us a painting as a farewell gift. I'm sure they would have had something to say about it.
I believe he defends his role and the role of, you know, en profond in Bosnia as obeying the rules of engagement and doing the job they were given, which is guarding the convoys of aid and food. Yeah. You know, how would you react to that?
Well, yes.
Did they do that job?
Well, they did that, but they were also involved in when NATO finally lost its temper, if you like, and then they decided to start attacking the Serb forces, which of course resulted in a very quick peace, which should have been done years beforehand. So I think about 1995 was my last trip out there, and that's when they were having the fighting going on. We saw the airstrikes taking place and went up to see the artillery batteries that were firing on the Serb positions. So, if you like, it was the last active service visit that the magazine made. So it was quite interesting photographically and feature-wise.
And should that have happened earlier then?
Personally, I think it should have done. The UN should have seized the metal and gone in there with all guns firing and saying, "Stop fighting."
End of reel. Where are we? 12. Laurie Manton. Thank you, Laurie.